Okay, guys, before we jump into this week's podcast, usual reminder to sign up for a game-changing weekly e-letter. Goes out to hundreds of men across the world on a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Link will be in the show notes. If not, it's wholemanacademy.com/movement. Right, let's jump in.
Whole Man Academy. Because the world needs strong men. Whole Man Academy is changing the game for men around the world. It's for guys who want to live an epic life of fun and adventure, no matter what. We believe, deep down, all men want to go on their own hero's journey to becoming resilient, confident, fearless, and fulfilled. Listen in to be inspired by guys who don't settle for living a life of mediocrity. This is your call to action and call to adventure. Are you ready?
Okay, so this is the Whole Man Academy podcast, episode 118. My guest today is Neil Kramer, writer, philosopher, teacher. He's taught me a lot without even realizing it. He wrote the book Unfoldment, which is the organic path to clarity, power, and transformation. We're going to talk briefly about that. He also wrote and narrated a film, which I have watched twice, Transmutation, which is a journey down a spiritual path. So trying to think of a shortened version of what it is. So we're going to get into some deep topics today, but let's start with how are you and where are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me. That's how I am. Where am I? I'm in Washington State in the United States. So physically, I'm located on the west coast of America, but as you can probably tell by my voice, I'm originally from the northwest of England. So I'm a Mancunian who has wandered further afield. So that's where I am.
And what's life like? I mean, we're going to get into some deep topics. I know your work kind of, focuses on, I can't always spell them, mysticism, metaphysics, spirituality,
sure.
Different paths, but just a basic one. I just wondered, because you do a lot of, talks and, public talks, like that, I just wondered what it was like during lockdown, because of course, all of that stopped. And, for some people, it was a nice experience. Others found it really hard. So what was it like for you?
So America, some people will know this, some of your listeners will know this, forgive me, but for those who don't, America is basically 50 mini countries, which they call states. So it heavily depends what state you are in. Yeah. So if you're in Texas, you may not have noticed anything was happening. If you were in New York, it was like bad. It was like London or Paris or whatever. In Washington, where I am, which is in not Washington, D.C., Washington State is just above Oregon, just next to Idaho. So it's in the extreme northwest of America. Again, it depends whereabouts you are. If you were in Seattle, which is our sort of major city, it was awful. Right. If you drive an hour away from Seattle, an hour and a half away westwards, so I live, that's how far I am from Seattle, quite a long way. If you're in a rural place, and you go into small towns, you may not notice. Mm. You may not notice. You just think, why are those people wearing masks?
Yeah.
There's no lockdown. There's no such thing where I was. There's nothing remotely like that. There was advice and some people had followed it. Most people ignored it. So I suppose my answer is, for me, I hardly noticed because of how I live and what I choose to do and not do. And it's very difficult to enforce genuine totalitarian laws in the United States because of the Constitution. So they made it look like they were saying, you have to do this, you have to do that. But technically they couldn't. And so the only people who did observe lockdown and wear masks and get vaccinations were people who chose to do that off their own back, which in my view is very unwise and unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But nobody I know, no thinking person I know, did any of those things. They didn't. But that's a facet, again, of where you are in the United States, which is freer than anywhere else I've ever been. And I've traveled relatively widely.
Yeah.
It is freer here. It's crazy. It's the Wild West. It is. But it's freer. And if you live in a state like Texas or Idaho or South Dakota or, I don't know, Arizona or Tennessee, it's very free. Florida, very free. Very, very free. And some of those places didn't really do what everyone else was supposed to do. Yeah. So it varies, depends where you were.
It's kind of summed up for me. One of the interesting ones, I had a friend that went to Tanzania, and I remember him saying, as soon as he got off the plane, there was a little bin to put your mask in. And he said, I basically took my shoes off and that was it for the rest of the time.
That's marvellous. I love that.
Until the, was it the president died suddenly? What happened to him, I wonder. But
goodness, right, yeah, yeah.
But you're right. I think, you know, we live out in the countryside, so I'm in kind of 40 minutes north of Oxford. So we're in a quiet village.
Lovely.
Like you say, I'm very glad we moved out of London 6 years ago, and I would not want to have spent my time, you know, on a, doesn't matter how expensive your house is, but when you've got lots of people around you looking at what you're doing and who's coming and going, it's an interesting time. But
yeah, it's just crazy. It's wrong to do. Anyone who's doing that, participating in that, enforcing it, you know, subjecting themselves to it, it's wrong. It's just wrong, period. There's never any excuse for that ever.
Well, it's certainly been a, I think, to say the least, a challenging, you know, physically and mentally for a lot of people. It's been a bit of a test in the last 2 years. But, you know, the Whole Man Academy, which was started back in 2018, was generally to encourage guys to get together to talk, because you know generally how rubbish guys are at doing that. And also kind of encouraging them to, for want of a better word, with personal development. In the US, you know, personal development is very big, whereas in the UK, we're a lot more, as you'll know, you know, don't high five me, don't you know, get too excited. I don't want
to. Don't touch me.
That's it, don't touch me.
I'm fine. I don't need help. I don't need personal development. I'm good.
Yeah, and
yeah, that's very British, isn't it? Yeah,
that was the difference I saw from, you know, I went out to Miami to like Tony Robbins conferences and different stuff like that, and I've been out to different places. And you know, the difference between the, you know, the English guys who were very and the American guys who seem very much more open. But I just wondered, what do you see as the landscape for men today? Because, you know, the I got one of the statistics I saw on Twitter. I hate Twitter, but sometimes it's useful for stuff. Sharing 2021, like, this is the interesting thing. Not only is the suicide rate ridiculous anyway, but there was four times as many male as females taking their own life in the US, I think last year or the year before. So it's kind of two ways of looking at it. One is, you know, why are so many people taking their own life? But secondly, for me, it's more about why is there four times as many men as women doing that? And I just wondered what your take is on the landscape for men. I know it's an expansive question.
Oh, yeah, it's a hell of a question. We could talk about that for a week.
Yes, yeah.
So my feeling about that is, for a man to have a whole life, using your word, which I think is a really good word, Whole Man Academy, for a man to have a whole life, he must recognize some pretty fundamental things in his life. For example, what is he made of? What kind of world is he in? And perhaps most importantly, what is his purpose? So you could say, as indeed I used to do in my early spiritual education, it's the composition of a man, the environment of a man, and the purpose of a man. These things must be known. If you don't really know those things, if you don't have answers to those questions, any man is going to fall into a state of despondency. And sometimes it might be a sort of secret, quiet disconnection kind of thing, where you just have a life of dissatisfying drudgery, you know, something like that.
Well, it's, or in struggle.
Yeah, or in more serious circumstances, as you're alluding to, just outright misery and depression and eventually spiraling self-destruction. You know, whether it's the sort of gentle kind or the brutal kind of problem, it's the same problem. And it is the problem of a man who finds himself drifting without a compass, without meaning. So a man needs to know what he is, where he is, and what he's doing. And that's where this question suddenly starts to come into a much more expansive, as you say, thing, which is, well, what is a man? What is he made of? He's made of a mind, he's made of a body, he's made of a spirit, he's made of a soul. What are those things? What are you here to do? What's the point of all this? And so I think where I come into this, which I think you know this, Anthony, but many of your listeners perhaps won't, or most certainly won't. Where I come into this is that I'm a spiritually focused man. I'm not really looking at the socio-political, economic, environmental, and cultural factors alone. I consider those things because they're part of our life for sure. But that's not where the answers are. It's not a socio-political, cultural problem. It's not. To know why people are struggling, you have to come into the realm of theology, which is basically what I do. I teach theology. And for listeners who are not familiar with that word, theology is the study of the nature of God and all sorts of related rational inquiries into that, spiritual questions, philosophical questions, the literature that surrounds it, the teachings that surround it. So you've got, you know, 2,000-4,000 years of stuff to look at. And the word theology comes from the Greek theos, which means God, and ology from logoia or logia, which means like a branch of knowledge, a study. So whenever you get ology or logia, that's what it is. So you could say, as I often do to people, that if biology and chemistry and physics are disciplines in observing the natural physical world, theology is the discipline of observing the supernatural non-physical world, or today you might call it the metaphysical world. Applied theology is the application of theological insights into your actual day-to-day life, your home, your work, your relationships. So for me, theological study, decades of it, has provided a lot of quality information, simple as that, very high caliber data, and if I may say, piercing wisdom, very ancient wisdom that's contained in the theological body. And of course, me as a student, I'm trying to get as much of that wisdom as I can, because I want to know things, I want to understand things, I want to live a life that is decent, not necessarily just for me, which we'll come to, but for a wider purpose than that. And I want to be a good husband to my wife, I want to be a good teacher to my students, I want to be a good son to my parents, I want to be a good brother to my friends, whatever. I want to make myself better, which I think all your listeners are sympathetic with. So I think I'm okay. I think I'm an okay guy. But what theology does is show you a much, much more profound picture. And it's for me, it's been very pivotal in forming a much more genuine, more mature, more reality-based picture of what is happening in this world. And as I often say as well, that one thing you've got to do is say that the Christian theological picture is very divergent from the kinds of things that you would hear unconsciously recited in normal institutionalized religion, normal churches. That's not what I'm talking about. And I'm sad to say that, because it shouldn't be that way, but it is. So true spiritual study and practice is a very countercultural thing. And it's part contemplation, it's part scholarship, it's part embodiment, and it's part inner regeneration. And I would go so far as to say that without a rudimentary theological lens, you cannot see what is happening in this world. You won't be able to detect and deal with all the decay and distortions and mess. You won't be able to. A person just ends up going around in circles and improperly identifying the reasons why things are the way they are. I say that with conviction, because I've done it myself. Mm, yep. It doesn't work.
Through life.
It's not a socio-political problem. It's not. So the theological picture puts a supernatural layer over it. And that's where you lose a lot of people, because they can't deal with stuff that is not nuts and bolts. So it requires an awful lot of study and a lot of patience. And for me, I'm a very nuts and bolts guy. I'm not a new agey guy. I'm not a, you know, floaty person. I'm very, very grounded, very solid. Touch it, smear it, you know, smell it, feel it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it took me a very long time to substantiate the very existence of a divine entity of any description, and that there's any supernatural stuff. I needed to see it. I needed to experience it. I needed to be close to it, have proximity, reject it, test it, evidence it, like a detective. You know, I had a hunch something was going on, but I had no evidence. So it's a bit like one of those movies where you go to the boss and say, I think this is what's happening. And the police boss says, yeah, well, where's your evidence? You can't take that to court. They'll laugh you out of the courtroom. You need data. You need hard evidence. Go and get it and then come back to me. So it was like that. It was like, okay, I'm going to gather every scrap of evidence I can for and against and see if there is a divine creator. And I had no hope and no expectation. I don't give a shit if there's no God. It doesn't make any difference to me. There's no God and it's just atoms and galaxies and DNA. Fine. Absolutely fine. I couldn't care less. That's absolutely easy peasy. No problem. If there is a God and he has a plan and we're part of it, that's very important. That needs to be examined carefully. And I came to the conclusion that there is. And, you know, all my work basically is the pieces of that evidence, and people gradually examine it because they can tell I'm a, you know, a reasonable person. I don't just believe stuff.
Yeah.
I don't just have empty faith. I need to know, as far as any man could know anything, I need to see it. And so people are interested because they can feel there's something bigger going on. But our churches have not taught us very well. Some do, very few, but most don't. The New Age world is rubbish. That doesn't teach us anything. I don't think the Asiatic systems have a good world picture. I don't think Buddhism provides an adequate picture, or Hinduism, in my view. No disrespect to one of those people, but it's not the right picture. They're not all true. It's not. There's not like lots of truth. There's one truth. And my study of 30 years, from 20 to 50 years of age, comfortably that, probably a bit more, but you don't want to sound crazy saying you started when you were 12 or something. But, you know, you have an inkling when you're a teenager, there's something big going on in the world. You know the adults have fucked it up. You know that this is a mess. You know that the politicians are rubbish. You just know. And then most guys by the age of 25 have thrown all that away and stopped caring about it and just concentrate on their own happiness. I wasn't like that. I wanted to know why at all costs. And my whole life is just given to that process. So I don't expect anyone to go along with me. I'm not trying to convert anyone. I couldn't care less what people think. But I have discovered things. And my work basically is just, you know, my field notes that people can look at and listen to and make their own mind up. If they think it's great, good. If they don't, fine. Doesn't bother me. So it's a very genuine approach. It's a very sort of personal inquiry. And even the scripture itself, you know, it encourages us to test the spirits, to test God, to test the prophets, to test the literature, not just go along with it. That's not what the Bible supports. It says, if you don't buy this, investigate. If you're not sure, investigate. That's what it says about itself. And so some people like me, it takes 3 decades to be certain before you waste any time. And other people, it takes 5 minutes and they've not properly looked. Oh, I don't believe all that. They don't know what they're saying that to. And similarly, you have the other problem, which is people who absolutely believe it and they don't know what they're believing. So you must substantiate it. Any whole man owes it to himself to substantiate what he's putting his attention on. So that's the theological importance here. And I think that picture explains why mainstream life is bollocks, basically, is rubbish. That picture is a very clear historical document, say like in the book of Daniel, an Old Testament document written thousands of years ago. And Daniel identifies, for example, 4 kingdoms, 4 empires, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And then he says, and that empire will become a sort of internationalist empire. And it's one body that stretches through time. And it's wicked. It's evil. It's satanic. And it's set against the welfare of human beings. And that empire stretches throughout the millennia. And it's not your friend. And it's international. It's an international thing. And today it's what you'd call the deep state or something like that. The internationalists, the globalists. You try and avoid stupid words for it. So I decided to borrow the Old Testament language for the problem, which is empire. There is an empire all over every country, 180 countries or whatever, and it's a problem. Now, that theological picture is so accurate. That was a major sort of, you know, key turning event for me, that in the Old Testament, they'd nailed the problem. What, you know, one part of the problem, they'd nailed it. And it's accuracy and it's historical reality. You know, it's not mythology, scripture. It's a historical document. They nailed it. And I thought, okay, that's good. That was a piece of evidence. They nailed the problem from, you know, 600 BC to today. They nailed it and described culprits and described methods and described why and who was behind it. And that was important. So that's just an example of a theological premise, which the student is free to examine, because it's quite a bold statement, some of those things I've said. I'm conscious of that. So you have to substantiate it. So the diligent observer of reality always substantiates his premises, his hypotheses. He does. You don't just believe stuff. So don't think theology is religion. It's not.
I find it, because it's like at the moment, so many people are busy with life that they don't have time to even question what's going on around them or anything.
Right.
Anything deeper than what's going on. And I was one of those people. I mean, for 20 years, I worked in the city, and you know, my priorities were getting to work, making loads of money, you know, not making fuck ups, dating, trying to find the right girl to settle down with. And I remember back then, kind of, I didn't have time for any of that. And things have only escalated from there.
Well, you did have time for that. Yes,
I just didn't.
But you hadn't arranged time for that.
That's it. And it would never have occurred to me. Probably if I'd have listened to you back then, it had just gone completely over my head. And that's where I see, I mean, so many guys I've interviewed either for the podcast or guys through the Whole Man Academy are on the hamster wheel, and
right.
to kind of try and divert some of their energy off to thinking deeper just seems to be like beyond them. I mean, a great example is, you know, it's like with TV. I mean, I don't watch normal TV anymore. I haven't for probably a year and a half, but I experienced it the other night when I went to my parents' house, and you know, they still had on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Oh, goodness, yeah, yeah.
Like, wow.
That's rubbish, isn't it?
I felt like I was being terrorized, but I had to watch it just to see, and I was like, shit, I used to watch this stuff. And people are so distracted by the war, yeah, this and that, that it's like they don't have time for anything deeper at all.
Yeah. No, it's a problem, which is, you know, that I spoke to a mature spiritual lady in a sort of early 60s recently. And we were having a discussion, and we were discussing that very thing about time. And I said to her, I said, you know, in your experience, in your decades of spiritual study and scholarship and practice, what would you say, I asked her, what would you say is the number one sort of spiritual skill? And she said, availability. She said, you have to make yourself available to life, to look at it, to stand back, to create space, to observe it, to think about it, to sit with it, to be with the creator, to be alone, to sit under a tree, whatever. You have to create space. You have to make yourself available to observe. She said, most people's problem is they fill their life with activities. And she said, I don't care what they are. She said, that's a mistake. You have to make space and silence and stillness one of your activities. So it's a not doing, of course. It's a contemplative action, which means you are not doing anything. You're being with divinity. You're being with stillness and silence. And in that space, self quietens down. You know, your ego, your personality, being Anthony, being Neil, that quietens down. And something else, another faculty of the man, the whole man, his soul comes to the fore. So soul presence requires a certain stillness and silence to see, to feel, to cultivate it. Say like a martial artist, you know, it's not just go, go, go. His stillness, his poise, his calm is part of his power. If he's just aggressive and going crazy, he's weak in his combat. If he has centeredness and he has patience, and he's controlling his emotions and quiet, his power is doubled, especially in things like Aikido and whatnot. Enormous power from very modest forms, and karate and kung fu and things like that, which I know a little bit about some of those things. This is a similar thing. You're developing a faculty of yourself, which is non-physical. It's not an activity. There's no product. There's no service. It's a part of a man, his soul, which is the ultimate part of you, the bit that goes onward or not, you're developing that faculty. And that requires a cessation of activities completely. So whether you're just carving out an hour for yourself or 8 hours a day or 20 minutes, it's up to you. It's not meditation. Contemplative practice is not the same thing. That's not what it is. Meditation is okay, but that's not been a satisfying spiritual practice for myself or anyone I've ever met who's a serious spiritual practitioner, much to people's surprise sometimes. I'm not denigrating it for others, but it's not been effective for me. Yeah. Contemplation has been, which is a availability of oneself, a presence. The old desert monastics say, like, you know, in the 4th and 5th century in Egypt, these were like Christian monks, basically, who started off the whole monastic movement in a manner of speaking. They were called the Desert Fathers. They looked and lived very much like Jedi people, frankly. So they wore similar garments and they had similar abilities, it was reputed, which sometimes is nonsense, but occasionally there's some very compelling cases for it. And one of the things they used to do was, you know, seclude themselves away from everything to create this contemplative space. And it was, they said that the more a man silences his mouth and his body and his mind, the deeper he can see into reality. He can see things that cannot normally be seen. He can hear things that cannot normally be heard. And his what they would call watchfulness increases. And a wisdom comes upon such a man. And he's not doing anything as such. He's not even thinking, really. He's just silently being there. And so this contemplative practice, you know, has totally left normal mainstream society. No one even knows what this is. No one talks about it. Religious people hardly do it. And those who do, it's just a mimicry of it. But the actual thing itself is an incredibly important part of a man's life. When I coach people, I'm mostly teaching as a sort of educational thing, but there are people I speak to who come for, you know, mentorship and coaching and whatnot, for sure. And there has been for a long, long time. And I'm happy to do that with certain people who, you know, they're looking in the right direction, in my view. And if they are, they know that activities need to be tempered and need to be controlled. And so we literally like look at what portion of the day are they doing what, how much work, how much play, how much contemplation, how much study, how much renewal. And most people are saying, so I get the work bit, I get the play bit. And what was that about renewal and contemplation and study? What are you talking about?
Because we're not taught it, are we, from a young age?
We're not. We're not. It's work and play. It's like work hard and then leisure, you know, just like wine, women and song, or, you know, yachts and paintings and, you know, wristwatches. I like wristwatches, actually. I shouldn't say that. But, you know, it's not play. So a man's life is not whole, in my view, unless he has contemplative time, study time, and regeneration time, which is literally to take himself off in retreat, to regenerate in, you know, to swim, to sleep, to eat, to walk, to listen, to turn his, have no phone, no computer, you know, to be elemental, basically. And so the very first thing I do when I'm meeting a new student, a new client, is examine how they spend their time. And it's usually work and play and nothing else. And that's the first thing that has to be gone, which I know is one of the things you'd mentioned, yeah, about inner strength. You know, if you were to ask me, as we were discussing earlier, what is it to build inner strength? You know, because you'd observe that, yeah, you'd observe that many men know how to do outer work. They get the bodies and the diet and this and that in decent shape, perhaps. But what about inner strength? What's that? I would say inner strength is centeredness in the face of everything. It is, as we said earlier, it's knowing what you are. It's knowing where you are. You know, what world are you in? What's this world for? And what should you do in it? Especially in relationship with divinity. So what is inner strength to me? I would say it's decades of going into the abyss of self and mapping it and recalibrating it and regenerating it with various psychological and philosophical and spiritual tools and instruments and methods. And after a while, someone who's known the abyss of self, which is the enemy of a man, his unknown self, once you're acquainted with that and you've been, you know, you've kind of put the rope over into the abyss and rappelled down, you know, like an SAS or a Navy SEALs guy, and you've gone deeper and deeper into the abyss of yourself, all its shadows, all its shame, all its inadequacy, all its abandonment, and all its nobleness, all its magnificence, all its dignity, all its excellence. When you've mapped that terrain, you start to resonate strength. So I would say that inner strength is a direct portrayal of the awareness of your own abyss, which I'm borrowing language again from earlier centuries here. This is how it was talked about in the Reformation period in the sort of 1500s. They said there's this thing, there's this abyss, and it needs to be known. Because if a man doesn't know himself, especially the shadows of himself, as you might say, he can't have strength. He's always pretending, which is what you find with a lot of people, a lot of human beings, a lot of middle class, working class, upper class, you know, French, German, American, Italian, whatever. You see people who are pretending strength, pretending happiness, pretending success. And it's fraudulent, and they know it's fraudulent, but they won't admit it to themselves, and they certainly won't admit it to anyone else. What the abyss does is destroy that pretense. It strips that away and says, okay, you have to come to your knees, you know, like on the mountaintop with your hands in the air and say, I don't know what I am. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what this world is. That moment has to be achieved. You have to come literally to your knees and have this shattering corrosion of self and realize that what you'd made, the tower you'd made, was false. It was nice. It was interesting. It got some stuff done, but it's not true. So it's a deconstructive process. It's the start of inner strength. And then you decide that every brick that I put back into place is going to be true, or it doesn't go in. So everything I do, my work, my home, my relationships, my philosophy, my theology, the music I listen to, the food I put in my mouth, the clothes I put on my back, they're going to be true and decent and authentic, or I'm not doing it. So it's an avowal. It's a devotion to truthfulness, inner strength. The truthful man is a strong man. And especially in the face of a false consensus like COVID, a false consensus, knowingly false, the truthful man is not afraid to go against the grain. He's not afraid to go against the apparent consensus. It's all very well being truthful secretly in your bedroom or driving in your car all on your own.
Twitter. Yeah.
Or on the keyboard, yeah. But doing it against the popular, against the overwhelming cultural norms is important. So inner strength is definitely a sign of a truthful man who is committed to truth, come what may. So that's the picture that I would paint of this very interesting question that you and I were talking about earlier. That picture of inner strength is, I think, is an accurate one.
I like it. And I will be, how can I put it, making sure I write all that down. And then I publish an e-letter to hundreds of men across the world on a couple of times a week. And I try and have thought-provoking content that isn't, how can I put it? It's okay to talk about, hey, what's your morning routine? If that can help a person get started in the day, and, you know, what you're eating and blah, blah,
right.
Blah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all these, I call them little tools to, you know.
Sure, sure.
But it's that deeper question. And it always links back to, I know we're, you know that we're home educating our boys.
Yeah, that's so excellent.
And we've actually got another one on the way in April. Don't know if it's a boy or a girl, obviously, but you know, if
wow, life, congratulations!
So life wasn't fun enough already. Then add in another baby just to
yeah, sure, yeah, why not?
But one of the big things for us is often, and I project this onto the men, you know, the middle-aged men, let's call it that, that I kind of primarily deal with. Mm. Like I said before, you're not taught any of this as you grow up. I mean, the spirituality, anything deeper than, you know, a bit of RE at school. And I worry for the youth of today when they are subjected to, you know, they're being taught masturbation in school from 4 years old in Scotland. And, you know, they're being kind of filled with white privilege and having things literally forced upon them. But, you know, whether people agree with that or not, the point is that there aren't the deeper questions asked in schools. And again, once you get older, it's so alien to have time to even think about that stuff.
I mean, it's vital to get your kids away from mainstream education. Vital. Especially during the very impressionable ages of, 7 to 14 years of age. Vital to keep them away from the mainstream. In Britain, America, Canada, elsewhere, I mean, it's the mainstream education is not edification of the mind. It's not upliftment of the human, endeavor. It's not. Educating at home, ideally, probably as part of some kind of homeschool network, whether in person or online, is a much better pursuit. And you're ensuring, very simply, that your children are receiving a quality, reality-based, broad, factually sound education, which is, of course, not involving the racism, the anti-European racism that mainstream culture has, and the sexual deviancy that mainstream culture has, and the, heritage denial that mainstream culture has. It's not, you wouldn't teach your children about critical race theory, which is racism. You wouldn't never teach them about white privilege, which is nonsense, absolute nonsense. You wouldn't. You might explain what they are, how they're perceived and what they look like in the culture, but you wouldn't teach the kid that because it's not true. Everyone knows it's not true. And the kids also need to learn social skills if they're being home educated, so they're not like little introverted pipsqueaks, They need to go to hockey and join a hiking club and go kayaking and play an instrument in a band and stuff like that. And, as they get a little older, learn how to go into the city and to travel and to go to restaurants and speak to people in banks and offices and train stations and, socialize, learn how to conduct themselves capably and decisively and confidently. They need those skills. That's part of home education. It's not just the books. Mm-hmm. And then, later when the kid is 14, 15, 16, they're in a better position at that age, if they've been home educated, to sort of collaboratively with the parents choose what to do next. Do they want to go to a school? Do they want to go to a mainstream college or an independent university? Or do they want to do vocational training? Or do they want to do nothing? Do they want to continue the self-education? So I think it's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. And if you have a family, you owe it to your kids to give them the best and most excellent education you possibly can. That's your job. It's not optional. And that is never sending them to the local school. Unless you're one in a million where you live next to a good one, which I've never seen anywhere in the world. That's unlikely.
Yes.
So you have to just tell yourself the truth that, as we know, think back to your school days. I went to a normal primary school, Church of England primary school. I went to like a semi-posh high school. And then I went to a normal art college. So I didn't have any extensive education as such. And I know people who went to very posh schools, and I know people who went to very rough schools. So, I have a picture of that. Yeah. And over the years, my work is essentially teaching work, coaching work, as I say. I speak to thousands of people. And I have the same picture from all of them. And it's that they have seen in their educational years from 7 to the 20s, say, right in front of their own eyes, that there's a massive inconsistency between, the honorable, noble educational precepts that you might say is in the brochure, and the actual shite that they received when they showed up at the place. It's a massive incongruity.
Yeah.
And, this gloomy procession of inept teachers and the shallow discussion of subjects, the repetition, the burden of unnecessary workload, which totally destroys the delight of knowledge and learning. And not to mention, of course, as we said, all the terrible things about sexuality and gender and class and ethnicity that are all garbage in the mainstream, garbage, garbage, garbage. So, the honest student realizes, whether they're a kid or a young adult, that it's not really about scholarship and individual critical thinking. It's about creating flat, uniform minds. And universities very, very, very rarely respect or elevate a mind. They create flat minds. I just actually wrote a piece for a lady who's writing a book about why the mainstream is rubbish, basically.
Yep.
And she asked me to contribute something to it very kindly, which I was privileged and glad to do so. And in that piece, I was one of the things I was saying that it's very sobering to remember, especially as an Englishman, that just after the Second World War in 1945, the bloody hilariously named Ministry of Education had the job of basically getting people back to work. That's note that the education was not about education, it was about work. So the Ministry of Education controlled compulsory education throughout England, and to this day they do. They just rebranded now as the Department of Education, but it's the same thing. So the goal was to get people to work, and if you were good with your hands, you'd work in a factory. If you were good with information and words and numbers, you'd go into an office. And the goal was the rebuilding of Europe with the long-term vision of a borderless European superstate and the eradication of distinct, homogeneous nations. That's what the Ministry of Education was for, not anything else. And so mainstream education is about getting people to work to build a European superstate, in my view. It's not about enrichment. It's not about illumination. Yep. It's about work. And it very much its secondary objective is to dissuade people from questioning the consensus view. And I know that sounds terribly pessimistic and terribly disconnected from, you know, the view of the marvelous universities in England and whatnot. But it's just what I've found to be the case, much to my disgust and horror. You know, not I'm just take no pleasure in that stuff. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, the lady I was talking about, she's a professor, a mature lady who's worked for, in, you know, top-notch places and whatnot. Same experience. And you know, she writes about this and talks about this, and she said it's the same thing. And it, rather like in the medical world, if you're a top educational person, you have to keep your mouth shut. Or you lose your money, you lose your department, you lose your grants, you lose your reputation, you're out. So you either keep your mouth shut and just repeat what everyone else does, or you have to leave. And this lady I'm talking about, she left and trod her own dignified, true path. But it's very, very contrary to the picture of, you know, Eton and Marlborough and Oxford and Cambridge that people see, or just normal schools in Manchester and Liverpool and South London and East London, whatever. You know, it's very, very different, very different picture.
Yeah.
So again, you have to take a view of that to say the education system is not there to help us. It's there to produce workers. I don't want to raise, if I don't have children, but if I did, I don't want to raise workers. Mm. I want to raise human beings. I want to raise men and women who are going to make choices and be strong and powerful and dignified in life, and have an illuminated mind, who are enriched and enjoy being a learner all the life, lifelong learners, everybody should be. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to inspire them to knowledge and to application and to creativity. That's the parent's job. That's what education's for. It's for edification, upliftment, elevation. You don't get that in the mainstream.
I looked up some of the stats. In 2019, in the US, there was around 2.5 million children being home educated, which I thought was really interesting. And in the UK, I mean, lockdowns, of course, pushed some people into it.
Right.
There is, you know, ridiculous restrictions on kids. And I remember talking to one of our friends who had a couple of kids at school, and I said to them, in between the two lockdowns, and I said to the kids, or I said to the mother, sorry, is, what's it like for the kids at school? Because I thought it'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah,
she said, it's not actually that different. And I said, oh, right, interesting. And then one of her children said, apart from we aren't allowed to sing anymore, we have to sit facing forward, we don't have story time, I can't speak to my brother or was it sister at playtime. There's a rope across the playground to stop us mixing. We have to sanitize our desks, you know, before and after, etc. And, you know, listed all these things. And when I was kind of like, looked at the mum like, and you don't think there's anything wrong with this. But I see that as so many, we've got a big community of home educating people. I've met a lot of them this afternoon.
Excellent.
You know, trying to work together. And the important thing I see is having the, how can I call it, the wise elders around as much as possible as well.
Nicely put. Yeah, I agree.
to just kind of give the kids, you know, some of the people we know, you know, lady in her 70s who's from the States, who's been a music teacher, very wise to things in the world. And she seemed to command a bit of a spell over the kids that mums and dads can't do, because the kids are just like, I'm not fucking listening to you, your mum and dad.
Right.
But that's where even we go with the men. I wrote down something you said, which is, this life is a gift of learning. Then as another part, we came here to grow, and growth brings wisdom. And that was part of your, I think, the trailer for the Transmutation film. And I wrote those down. And I just thought that was so good, because I remember reading about how important it was to keep on learning for your cognitive ability as well. But I just wondered, if you were trying to help someone get started on the deeper understanding of spirituality, for want of a better word, like where, you know, it's like if someone said, okay, go on then, you go, okay, where should I start? You're like, right. So I just wondered where you would start someone off.
Well, it depends on the individual. It depends on the individual. If there are intellectual person, then that would be one path. If they're a bodily, physicalized, you know, person, that's another path. If they're an emotional, you know, heart-led person, that's another path. The short answer to the question, though, is a teacher. Students need teachers. So just like you said, how can I start my kid off in learning German? A teacher. That's the number one thing. You need to find teachers. I've had, I don't know, 5 or 6 teachers in my life who've been very influential, and 6 or 7 ongoing teachers, you know, with different things, language, theology, scripture, philosophy, psychology, you know, things that are important to form a good worldview. Some of those teachers are pretty remote. I'm just reading, listening, watching. Some of them I shake the hands and we sit together and drink coffee and talk, which is awesome. And some are friends. You know, they're not just friends who just say stuff. They work as teachers. And, you know, I'm lucky to know them so we can share information and hang out and learn together. You know, to me, it's play. It's not work. It's play. It's easy and pleasurable to do this stuff. So the answer is, you've got to find teachers, credible, quality teachers who are essentially, if I may say, God-centered. If someone is world-centered, they're not going to teach properly. So you need someone who understands that, has a worldview of that nature. Now, if you're learning German language, that's not essential. You know, if you're learning carpentry, that's not perhaps essential. But if you're learning about psychology, about the mind, about the heart, about reality, about society, about life and death, and big questions in life, they must have a spiritual, theological framework. If they don't, there's a problem. And the other thing I would say is, it must be a factual, truthful spiritual picture. I don't just mean any spiritual picture. Most spiritual pictures are wrong. You know, that's the thing about theology. There's right and wrong. 2 + 2 = 4. It's not 3.9. It's not 4.1. It's 4. And if you think it's 3.9 and that's your spiritual picture, you're wrong. So there's not many truths in mature spiritual life. There's one. And it's like one mountain, and you can go to it and look at it and ascend it if you want, but you can't pretend it exists elsewhere. It's not. There's one truth. And our job is to try and access that truth and see it as best we can, educate ourselves into that truth. So, you know, let me give you a fast and dirty theological picture, which I think is sound, okay? So my essential theological framework looks like this. How can I say this? A transcendent, non-physical, intelligent entity created everything. And we call that guy God, for short. And he is making a family. And we humans constitute a very important part of that emerging family. And very simplistically speaking, he made the earth to educate his family and to identify which humans he can trust. In other words, in this classroom of Earth, will we use our free will well and honestly and bravely and honorably with dignity, I keep using that word, or not? Or will we not do those things? Will we be selfish, stupid, you know, idiots? So trustworthy humans are brought forward and given dominion over a new Earth. That's our home, not this. We're in a classroom now, not home. This is not our home. That's the theological picture that any serious theologian or Bible teacher or scriptural scholar would attest to. This earth is not our home. It's a classroom. If you attend to your education properly here, you go to your home and start your life in the new earth that is made. If you don't, if you are untrustworthy and selfish, you are obliterated. So I love that. I love that, that it's harsh, harsh. Not everyone makes it, true. And philosophically speaking, God, of course, could harness his omniscience to see the totality of all outcomes and know precisely who will do what. But despite that, he does not make the decisions for us. He allows us to do that for ourselves. So he grants us free will to see who we can trust with it. And so we either go onward or we consign ourselves to the bloody dustbin of eternal annihilation by our very own decisions in life. Like I say, did we live selfishly and world-focused, or did we live honorably, prudently, you might say, it's an old-fashioned word, and spirit-focused? So as you said about that transmutation intro, that documentary intro that I said some things on, you could say that Earth is a classroom. It's not a resort. It's not a playground. It's not a random collection of mountains and rivers. It's an academy of experiential spiritual precepts, and those precepts are designed to educate us and cleanse us and get us in good condition. And everyone knows that. I would propose everybody knows that, and you can either face it and do it, or you can ignore it and turn the other way at your peril. So we're not here for a laugh. We're not here to entertain and secure and fulfill ourselves. That's not what this is. It's not some random spasm of galactic coincidence either. We're placed here for training and qualification, and we are built to succeed in that regard. It's not a superhuman feat to go onward after death. It's what you're built for. So as soon as you start to stop treating Earth as a resort and treat it as a classroom, which is what it is, your life is going to get infinitely better. And the wholeness that is a principle in your project and mine too, is garnered from that understanding. No activity, no product, no service. It's from the understanding of your education in this world. And you only get 10 decades. It's all over really fast. You only get one chance at it. There's no reincarnation, no millions of lives in real spiritual picture, in my humble view. Right. I know lots of other billions of people think otherwise, and they're free to. But in my studies, you get one go. This is it. And in that 10 decades, your job is to demonstrate to God he can trust you. He can trust you with the keys to the kingdom that he's going to give us. And if you can't be trusted, you're obliterated. And I love that black and white, absolute incisiveness. No messing about, no airy-fairy, we all make it in the end. It's not true. But it's absolute equity, absolute fairness. Everybody has the chance to make it. And proportionately, you're tested according to your abilities. So if you're a simple-minded man, your lessons are going to be simple. If you're a sophisticated-minded man and you have the capacity for complexity and insight, God is going to test you more. So it's very fair. It's very proportionate. And that's the exciting thing for me, that if that picture that I just painted, and I'm aware it's very bold and audacious, but that is the scriptural picture. That's the Christian picture. And if that's true, it's incredible. And so, as I say, it took me a long time, about maybe 15 years, to substantiate that picture to my satisfaction. And I found, to my surprise, it is bloody true, as far as I'm concerned. And if somebody's got evidence to the contrary, I want to know, I want to see it, because, you know, that's, I just want the truth. I have no vested interest in this picture. It just seems to be, this is what it is. And if it is, that's incredible.
You just said, I just want the truth. And I just, I know of the film, you know, you can't handle the truth, but I'm not.
Yes.
To flip it back to Hollyweird. But that thing of, like, as you said, growth brings wisdom. And I happily admit, I would suggest I was sleepwalking through life until I got to my 40s.
Right.
Maybe that was the right time when, you know, people say, is it the old saying, when a student is ready, the teacher will appear?
Right, right. Yeah. I think everyone spends a portion of their life sleepwalking. Whether you wake up at 25, 45, 75, that's part of the plan. But everyone starts off sleepwalking. Yeah. It's normal.
That is, and it's good to know, because sometimes you can, how can I put it? Sometimes I can look and be like, man, I wasted so much of my time. Then I, as you said, you know, everybody, you know, no one was born enlightened, or everybody kind of treads their own path, as it were. And I definitely say, for me, I'm around much wiser people now. And it's become apparent to me that so many people I held in such high regard for various reasons, maybe it was business or in other sectors, are really clueless actually on how the world works.
Yeah, totally, totally. Like the Elon Musks of this world. He's no idea what's going on.
It's earth-shattering.
Or Jeff Bezos, or, you know, if we've got in England, you know, various entrepreneurs and business people and creatives and sportsmen. I mean, well done to them. You know what? Well done. There's no condemnation here. It's just the observance. They don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And I like to learn from people who do know what's going on. It's exciting. It's interesting. It's more interesting than anything else. Because you can have all the birds and booze and boats that you can handle, but they run out of juice. They run out of steam. They run out of interest. It's not enough. The whole a book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament is about a king who has everything, every woman, every drink, every boat, every palace. He has the lot. And the whole book goes on about him trying to enjoy it. Is it enough? And every chapter it ends up with, it's not enough. It's all futile. It's all futile. None of this means anything. And he's had more than me and you can ever dream of, more than Elon Musk can ever dream of. You know, the lavish luxuries this man had. And he ends up saying, you know, all of that is bollocks. All of that doesn't mean anything. It's about your connection to the creator. It's about your education. It's about learning about the human heart. It's about attending to the spiritual task that's set before you every day, which is called your life. Your home, your work, your relationships are your coursework. And so as long as you create time to work and play, sure, but time for study and contemplation and regeneration, you can set yourself to that task. You can attend to the education that God, through his living classroom, has set before you. You can't miss it as long as you look open, you know, with your eyes open and your ears open and your mouth closed. You can't miss it. So you have to have this, as we said about these desert fathers, watchfulness. You have to have this facet of cool, detached, calm observation. And you piece it together bit by bit, piece by piece. So just like the cool man in many situations, why is he cool? Because he's unruffled by the chaos around him. He's cool and detached. He's, you know, he's Clint Eastwood or whatever. The bullets are flying, but he's cool as a cucumber. And he does what needs to be done, and he's not concerned about what everyone else is concerned about. So it is in spiritual life. The spiritual Clint Eastwood is the man who is objective. He knows how to love. He knows how to dance. He knows how to kiss. He knows how to celebrate. But he also knows how to stand back, how to watch, how to listen, how to think. And that's the Renaissance picture of the whole man, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, there's quite a lot of this that will be used in various, you know, e-letters and posts and thoughts and stuff like that, because that's one of the, I mean, big reasons why I wanted to speak to you, because sometimes, not that I can begin to put into words the kind of stuff you do, but sometimes I found it really hard to kind of draw out of me the deeper side of what I want the Whole Man Academy to be, if that makes sense.
Sure. It's a puzzle, isn't it? It's hard to articulate these things. They're very nebulous. It's hard to put words to them for any man. I know myself. Yeah, I have the same struggles in different parts of life.
And it is frustrating because, sometimes you realize that, you know, I can listen to lots of different interesting stuff that will go deep on different topics. But how do you package that up into something that's bite sized for the average guy now who's got an attention span that's, you know, about 3 seconds or something? But I still enjoy the long form, like ours, long form content. And I would say sometimes I reckon now I could do a video where I give next week's lottery numbers out And I'll give that video to a lot of people and say, but it is 3 hours long, but the numbers are in there somewhere. And they'll say, I haven't got time. It's too long.
I haven't got time. Yeah.
Can't you give me a bullet point one in a 3 second snippet or something? But one of the big things the podcast has given me, to state the obvious, being like 117, 18, 19 episodes now, has been exposure to different guys more around the world. And I think I said in the email I sent you, I spoke to I called him a pastor last week, and never said it's not pastor, it's pastor. yes, darling, yes, sorry.
But that's right. Yes.
I got it slightly wrong. Well, I do love pasta. But he was talking about, I mean, he's from Texas.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, life was very good there compared to other states, as you kind of mentioned earlier.
It is indeed, yeah.
He and I were talking about the massive drop in, or the worrying kind of decline of numbers going to church. And for me, in this country, I see it where it's not just about the spirituality. It's also about just community. You know, if people want to come to church, because at least it gets everyone together, it's a start. And we went to our Harvest Festival in our little local village here. We've got a beautiful church. And Emma and I were the youngest people in the room.
I bet you were. I bet you were. That doesn't surprise me.
Our two children were the only children there. And everybody else was basically 65 upwards. And I
bet they were delighted to see you, though, weren't they?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. But the sad thing was, I said to Emma, I said, in 10 years' time, half the people in that room will be dead, unfortunately.
Right.
It's quite charming and cheerful, but where's the younger? And I just wonder for you what you're seeing in the States as well with the declining numbers, because it's as if there's an agenda to do away with Christianity.
Yeah, there is. Christianity, the other super cool thing about it is Empire, the bad guys, hate it. They don't hate Buddhism. They don't hate Hinduism. They don't hate the New Age. They don't hate atheism. They don't hate agnosticism or Wicca or anything. They don't, no problem. They hate Christianity, because Christianity has the world picture and identifies the enemy. That's why they hate it. One thing that happened is, I have to say, this is kind of, I'm going to upset a few people, but hey-ho, the Romanist sequestration of Christianity resulted in what we call Roman Catholicism. And that's when Christianity went off track in about 450 AD. That's when it went off track. And Roman Catholicism, in my view, has not represented Christianity at all well. And I'm saying that as diplomatically as I possibly can, using, you know, language that's not super offensive. If it was just me and you, I'd say it a little bit differently. But the principle's the same. It's not represented Christianity well at all. In the 1500s and 1600s, there was a great Reformation in Europe with people like Martin Luther and Ulrich Zwingli and all kinds of amazing, brave, incredible people, John Calvin, lots of people, who said, you know, this spiritual thing, the Catholics have not done a great job of explaining it. And they've actually killed 100 million people across Europe who questioned their interpretation of it. And that's a conservative figure. I'm not making that up. And it's not a high figure. And that's wrong. And you shouldn't have to do this. And they've added a load of traditions on top of Christianity, which are nothing to do with the Bible, scripture, nothing. The men have made them up. There's no mention of popes in scripture. There's no such thing. All of that rubbish. It's wrong. And we're going to start again. So really, we've only had really 400 years of a fresh view of what Christian reality actually is, which is a very short amount of time. That means that 90-something% of our churches are stupid, I'm sad to say, and I'd say that with no gladness. It's a disappointment. And most, you can have cute churches. I lived in Cheshire in England for most of my life, and there's loads of cute churches there, just like there is in, you know, Dorset and Oxfordshire and Wiltshire, and beautiful places, and, you know, ancient churches in Cornwall and Devon and stuff, beautiful, beautiful places. And don't dispute that. But who's teaching there? What's their scriptural scholarship? What's their knowledge? What's their knowledge of human beings? You know, what's that like? What is it? Is it any good? And mostly it's not. So what you're trying to do is one of two things, is get a recommendation for a real church, which is like hen's teeth. It's very rare. Or create a spiritual community yourself, which is, you know, what I'm doing in my own small way and what you're doing too, by the sounds of it. We're not just sat back moaning, belly aching about it, as they say here in the States. We're yeah. doing something. Yeah. We're doing something about it. And it's a small start, but it's something. And, it, you know, those things grow and grow, one would hope. So my attitude has been find spiritual community. If that's a church, great. If it's 12 guys sat in a circle at the health club, great. We have a sort of country club nearby. Sounds a bit posh, but it's not that posh. And you can hire a room there for nothing. You know, we pay like fees or whatever to be part of this thing. And it's got a swimming pool and, you know, a tennis court and a gym and stuff like that. I never do any of those things, of course. I just sit on a bench at the back and look at the lake. But you can rent a room and people do Bible study classes. They do, you know, card making, guitar lessons, Tai Chi lessons, whatever. And so anywhere you are, there's always some kind of community space where you can create something yourself and say, well, I just want to get together and talk about life and the universe and God and politics and people and the conservatives and Labour and, you know, the Democrats and Republicans and just, you know, just talk about it, you know, just let my guard down and just let's just get it off our chest and see what we can find out together. And if there's some reference materials that are valuable, like a Bible or like some, you know, mystical texts or some philosophical documents that are, you know, by wonderful men, wonderful people who care about us and who are like us and just clear thinking, honest, integral people, maybe we'll also bring those books with us and reference some of them and see what we can learn from them. And that's what a church is. So in Christ's day, a real historical figure, not mythological, totally real, massive evidence for that. What was the church in his day? It was like me and you and half a dozen of your friends and half a dozen of mine meeting every Thursday at my house. And we talk and we sit around and we listen. We share stories. We laugh together. We cry together. We learn and we go outside and have a cigar and a glass of wine and look at the stars. And then we all go home. Okay, lads, I'll see you next Thursday. Yep. That was the church. The word church comes from the Greek word ekklesia, which means the assembly of those who are drawn together and responding to God. That's what the word means. Church is not a religion. It's not an institution. It's not a big company as it's become. It doesn't have millions of denominations. It's that. It's men gathering together and women at home. That's the church. That's what it was for hundreds and hundreds of years. So I think we're having to basically reimagine that and start again and create small home groups. You can call it a church if you want, or you can just call it a spiritual group. You know, Neil has a spiritual group. He meets at the little, you know, community center in his little hometown. And Anthony has this, a group, you know, a bunch of guys get together and they go and do, you know, you might play golf in the morning, you might do something in the afternoon and talk, you know, all night long together. That's a group. And it's valuable. And you say, you know, let's do this again next month. Let's do it 12 times a year, just even that. So it's not just the ability to get people together. I've done that. I know you've done that. It's consistency. It's regularity. That's what's killing people. There's no regular touchstone for higher purpose for a man, you know, for dignity and humor and laughter and sharing and brotherhood and spiritual, you know, transcendent big things. But even the small things, just the friendship and the trust and the fellowship that men yearn for, it's very hard to find. It's very hard to get hold of.
Missing so much. And to state the obvious, in the, you know, 2 years of lockdowns, and also, let's be honest, when lockdowns finished, the governments had done such a great, although, you know, psychological behavioral insights teams had done such a great job of scaring people of germs and each other, that people were very tentative to even get back to things.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, you know, you'll probably shudder at this as well, because just before lockdowns happened was the 12th, I think 12th or 13th Whole Man Academy event we'd had in London. And we had
that's great
guys together sharing stories and having, you know, a full day, a whole Saturday. And then you go off for lunch, come back, and people would then go to a bar after, have a few beers.
Sure, sure. Sounds great.
The messages from guys saying, there's nothing else like this and the community hasn't got it, so how can we come together? And then when lockdowns happened, yes, we tried to go on Zoom, but, you know, it's not, there's nothing like being, like you say, in person. No. Outside
you got to smell each other. That's what I always say.
You know, there's nothing better than a proper man hug instead of kind of someone's trying to have a conversation on Zoom. But I just wondered for you also, because with changing the subject slightly, but going on to transmutation, I know I've watched it, and I'll quite happily admit the first time I watched it, I finished, I was like, I can't take it all in. Maybe it's a 3 or 4 watcher, because I bet you get knocked
out.
The watcher will get something completely different the second time to the first time to the third time. And I'll be right about it in the e-letter, because I think it's $5 to buy, which quite frankly is a
it's $5 to stream.
Stream, that's it.
And just to stream it, yeah. And then you can own it, and it's like a vast thing with commentaries and everything for $30 or 30, whatever it is. I forget off the top of my head. It's actually my friend, the director, Niles Heckman. It's essentially his project. It's his film, but I'm glad to be part of it, of course. Niles is a super guy. But yeah, it's inexpensive.
I mean, considering, I literally thought earlier when I was kind of looking up the price of it, realizing that basically we're paying more for a stick of butter than we are for that at the moment, you know, and
right,
which reminds people that, like we said, who can you find to help you, you know, start on that journey? I mean, there's a good example, is for the price of, you know, a blob of butter, you could go and sit and watch Transmutation and have your mind.
yeah, totally. So for the price of a blob of butter, I love that. I think I'll be using that phrase again.
New marketing.
Yeah, good, brilliant. Yeah, I'll give you credit for that. Or if you want to go for a price of a large pizza to own it, you can watch a super documentary, if I don't say so myself, but it's super because of all the different people who are involved. You know, there's lots of people. It's totally handmade. And it really, what Transmutation's about is the spiritual adventure is the coolest thing going. And that's it. And it's just say, oh, here's a bunch of people, some men, some women, from all different parts of life, all different heritages, who have found value in spiritual inquiry. It's a film basically to entice beginners to take spirituality seriously. And it's purposefully keeping church things at arm's length. You won't see anything like that in it. Yes. And when we do, it's criticism, not praise. So it's a film about the innate spiritual inclination or compass in a man, the innate ability and the innate drawing of a person to divinity. You know, your gravitation is the word I'm thinking of, to divinity. And we try and make it beautiful, and it's filmed, you know, in the places that I go. So there's lots of forests and, you know, some cool places and hotels and beaches and deserts and interesting things to look at. So because it's Niles Heckman film, it's very beautiful. Niles knows about things like that. And it's a layered film. It is. So you'd watch it 5 times, you know, when you can be bothered to watch it again. And each time you'll see something different, because it's purposefully layered in that there's like really 5 or 6 things going on at the same time. So the first time you watch it, it's like listening to, you know, a piece of classical music, a symphony. You can't really take it all in. You know, if you're listening to Beethoven or something, you listen to it and you're like, that was nice. And I've got a feeling for it. I've got a sense of it. But of course, if you like Beethoven, you go back and listen again and again, and then you listen to the violins another time. The other time you're listening to the horn section or whatever. Another time you're listening to the, you know, the strings and the cellos and this and that. And you're like, okay, you know what? I've listened to this 10 times. This is the first time I'm hearing that bit of it, that delicacy or that tone. And this is like that. It's like the visual equivalent of it, that it's purposefully layered. There's a lot going on at the same time. There's a lot of, as you might say, instrumentation in it. Yeah. So I'd be very glad if people have a look at it and see what they think. And it's very inexpensive.
And that's the thing. It's,
you know, it's not hard to do.
Just gets people started. And again, when Emma and I sat and watched it together, you know, that must have been during one of the first lockdowns. And, you know, very much for me, I sat there at the end and was like, I need to watch it again. And probably.
Sure.
But I just wondered for you, if you took, I mean, we're, you know, coming towards the end of November, let's say, it feels like we're racing towards the end of November, like a year from now, I just wonder where we will be in the world. Either some people would like us to be at a world war, other people would have us be in lockdown, some people really enjoyed them. And I just wondered for you, you know, what do you see coming in the next year? Because they're throwing, you know, we're being thrown challenge after challenge, left, right and centre.
Oh, that's a hell of a question, isn't it? Yeah. My answer is I don't know. That's the short answer. I don't know. I've no idea. As to what I feel, I can talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, great.
I don't have no idea. But what I feel is that the bad guys, the enemy, they basically exist under the orchestration of their master, who was created to test us. So the word in Hebrew, Hasatan, means the adversary. And it's like a title or an office rather than a proper name. Say like the office of the prime minister or the office of the president or the office of the chairman. So Hasatan's job, the Satan's job, is to test us and to prosecute us. That's what he's made for. And so he tries to persuade us to yield, basically, to give in, to resign our goodness and truthfulness and just become part of the problem, just become part of the, you know, apathy, part of the falsehood, part of the immorality that is so pervasive. So the Satan is not God's cosmic adversary. He's ours. He's our earthly tester. He's our earthly foe. And over and again in my studies, when I examine history for, you know, roughly 2000 BC to 2000 AD, you know, documented history, you cannot get away from the fact that the bad guys venerate this character, this Hasatan, this the Satan adversary. So that's where, we get the word Satan from. They willingly ally themselves to this force. So as I said, from ancient Egypt to Babylon and the horrors of Rome and the current disgusting globalist deep state immorality, the deviance that they're trying to mainstream, the bad guys always do that. They always go against God. It's nothing new. It's nothing. What we're seeing at the moment is not unprecedented. What is unprecedented is the availability of information. So now there's no excuse for someone not knowing what's happening. You can find that out. And what is a vaccine from AstraZeneca or Pfizer or Moderna or whoever, Johnson & Johnson, what is that? What's in it? Do I need it? Have they ever isolated the vaccine in a human, the virus in a human being? No. So how can you produce a vaccine for something that you've never isolated in a human being? And what is a vaccine that doesn't stop contraction or transmission or effect? Not a vaccine. So anybody with a brain and a keyboard can find that out, right? Anybody. What's happening in Ukraine? It's a deep state black site. It's a money laundering operation. It's not an innocent country that Putin, the power mad crazy man, has just invaded. That's not true. And that can easily be substantiated, easily. So there's no excuse for what's going on. So I think the period of testing at the moment is, given the absolute availability of information through the keyboard, and anybody with an internet connection or a cell phone even, will somebody care what's true? Will somebody care what's true, or do they not care? Do they just want to be happy and comfortable and secure? Those people are part of the problem. So the terrible picture is that at the moment, what we're being shown, what we're witnessing, is that the majority of human beings who don't care what's true are part of the problem. They become evil. They don't care if they're nice. That's not relevant. You become evil when you stop caring what's true. So I think what we're witnessing is an acceleration of that process. And once it's been decided at this acceleration point of God's teaching, who cares and who doesn't? You know that you're now being shown something beyond all reason. COVID has been the most incredibly instructive thing I've ever seen in my life about people who don't care what's true. They don't care what's true. And that has been incredible to witness that, incredible. So I think you're seeing more of this about gender reassignment in kids and, you know, white supremacy, white privilege, garbage, of course, absolute garbage, and the exploitation of, you know, human beings. We're witnessing that so people have an opportunity to refute it and to go against it and to seize upon truth and decency and morality and probity instead, real things. And that test is accelerating. So what I see is hopefully much more suffering. I would personally like to see that in the world, even though I wouldn't wish it on me. Worst enemy, never mind my friends and family. We have to suffer to see what's true because we're so lazy otherwise. There must be an increase in suffering. I hope so. And I hope it's short-lived. And I hope it's mostly non-physical. People need to see that the world we've been pissing around with is evil. It's evil. And it's evil by design. And only when someone has acknowledged that can we actually change it. So it's like God waits for this consensus to be revealed as false. And he waits for what scripture would call a remnant, a small number of people to know the truth. And I think that process is accelerating. You can see it out there. And it's scary, especially, you know, with regard to people in your position, you've got a young family. But yeah. I don't think you've got anything to worry about with that, as long as you love what is true. Because when you love the truth, you have a certain supernatural protection. It's not infallible, but I've seen it too many times in my life to discount it. And so that's part of the mystery of what faith is, which is essentially, what is faith? A relationship. It's nothing to do with belief. It's a relationship. So if you have a father who you trust, and he never lets you down, and he always wants what's best for you, and he always does the right thing, if you trust in that relationship, truthfully, you have a degree of protection. So the other thing that's being tested is courage in the face of diversity, bravery, you know, old-fashioned values, nobleness, valiance. I mean, how often do you hear those words these days? Not very too rare. But the part of what makes a man, is his courage. So the suffering also brings out courage, real courage. So it's not a pessimistic wish. It's something that will actually put the final cracks in empires, whatever, edifice. You know, it's construction. It is failing. The bad guys are on the back foot for the first time in a long time. They are in a terrible condition because their strength comes from invisibility, not, you know, preposterous totalitarianism. That doesn't last very long. So once they've been exposed, which they have been, if anyone wants to look what a deep state is, you can see it now, they're weakened. You know, they're near extinction. So the suffering period will just be the period that normal people recognize evil for the first time. That's going to create some problems in the world. But I don't mean Mad Max, you know, scavenging weird end of its world stuff. No. Just a psychological collapse in a lot of people. You're going to need help and guidance and love and patience and compassion and forgiveness and lots of human things like that. So our job is to watch what's happening, to track it, and to be able to a degree, communicate it to anyone who wishes to listen.
You'll be pleased to know we have chickens and we're growing our own food. So if the apocalypse does happen, then we'll be mildly prepared.
Perfect, perfect. But we'll come round to your house for chicken sandwiches then, yeah.
I wondered, do you think also that life for, especially let's just say the UK for argument's sake, for the average person has been so easy for a long time?
Yes.
Because, I mean, to the state now that obviously, you know, if you're in London or any city, you can pick up your phone and get someone to deliver an ice cream or a coffee to your front door in 10 minutes.
Right, right.
Whatever you
Same
want.
Same here, yeah.
And sometimes I see that where, you know, it's the bread and circus of, let's say, football. I mean, the World Cup's just about to start. That's comedy. I mean, I am a great lover of football, but I've gone off it completely when I realise how much of my life I would figure I could have spent on slightly more important
right.
things.
Right.
I do see it where so many people, even the last 2 years, they're like, yeah, you know, lockdowns, but they were working from home, you know, probably saved a lot of money because they weren't traveling. Yes. And so they just carry on as normal. And you're like, do you think anything strange could be going on? Like, no. And I just wonder whether it's just life has just been so cushy for a while that it's very hard to see anything else.
Yeah, I love that. That's a... what's that? Del Trotter, cushy,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Del Boy, yes.
Del Boy, yeah. No one in the States will know what on earth we're talking about when we say that. Cushy, it means comfortable, doesn't it? It means, you know, yeah. It's easy. It's safe, you know what I mean? So kushti, it is too kushti for people. And one of the deconstructive precepts that is embedded into the earth classroom is suffering. Suffering. That's a very a critical part of the life experience is to suffer. And that process is not quite what people think, because you think suffering's bad, you know, like you're in a hospital, and say, oh, we don't want this person to suffer, we want to make them well and send them home. The word suffer comes from the Latin suffere. The two particles of the word, the first bit is sub, S-U-B, which means up or under, above or below. And the operative particle is the second part of the word, phere, which means to carry or to bear. So to suffer means to face what is painful or disagreeable or distressing. It means to endure, basically, to face things. It doesn't mean to agonize and to be, you know, having a terrible, terrible physical problem or anything like that. The word suffer means to look at what is real, to sustain, not to sink under, to face reality. And I think that principle, therefore, is very clever how, you know, God's, as usual, you know, sort of orchestrated this. He said, if their self is false, they will suffer greatly. If their self is true, they'll suffer a little. So, like an athlete would suffer and say, you know, no pain, no gain. And he pushes himself, or a special forces guy pushes himself. He's still just a man, but he's less afraid than you and me. He's more agile than you and me. He's got better instincts. And, you know, why? Why? Because he's allowed himself to suffer. His suffering has produced excellence. So it's like a discipline is, you know, a substitute for that. To be disciplined is to excel, like the discipline of a musician, a virtuoso, or the discipline of an athlete, as we say, or the discipline of a soldier. So suffering and discipline make you better. And I think that's why I would wish for suffering, because it will make people more truthful. And when their beer and football and gambling has been removed, as George Orwell says, they'll be forced to look at things. So you have to take away the distractions. You have to stop watching stupid things and stop playing basically like a child and be a man and look at the hard, cold, brutal world around you like a man. Like a man does. And when you look at that, you start to live truthfully for the first time. When you look at that, and it will bring pain, you will suffer in the traditional sense of the word, but that suffering decreases as you start to realize what's going on. So I see evil all the time, but it has less and less impact on me as I've understood what it is. You know, when I first didn't know what it was, the avoidance of it created all sorts of problems. I don't do the negative. I don't do evil. I don't do this. You know, we're taught to do that. That creates massive problems. Positive thinking is stupid. What you want is whole thinking to address the positive, to address the neutral, to address the negative, to be unafraid of the shadow, unafraid of the light, to have the full spectrum approach to reality, which means you have to know evil. You have to. That's why we're here, to study evil. And once you study it, it loses its sting. It loses its sort of spectral fear. And instead, you start to realize it's a kind of teaching mechanism. And ultimately, it goes away. It's defeated. So in the meantime, you learn how to combat it, how to refute it, how to destroy it, how to perceive it. That's a major reason why we're here, to be able to differentiate between good and evil. So I think that process is accelerating at the moment in the world. And you can see it everywhere. And although it's unpleasant, no question, although it's difficult, I wish it wasn't happening in a way, selfishly. When I stand back, when I'm objective and detach myself emotionally just for a second from it and look at it, it's a good thing. We have to suffer more.
Yes.
For a while, it's a process. And once that suffering has taken place to a certain degree, the truthful people will make themselves known to God. And this classroom has then served its purpose. It's a finite classroom. It doesn't go on for millions of years.
Joe, and it's that thing, I mean, you've summed it up beautifully, but I said it, you know, it hasn't got painful enough for enough people yet.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. That's a nice way of summing it up. I could have said it as brief as you. You're right.
One of your laugh, I mentioned this on a podcast a few weeks ago. One of my many observations over the behavior of, let's say, men in the last 2 years was that when lockdowns happened, of course, there was lots of different protests around in all different cities, and the media didn't like to show it, but there was, because I knew different people that were going to them. Because I firstly knew what our freedoms being taken away, but also what it would do to people's mental health, etc. But here's what you'll laugh at. You know, a lot of either friends I knew or just general guys couldn't be asked to go to that kind of thing because, you know, you had to actually do it. But right. If you remember, they then said that they were going to create the Super League. So, the Premier League teams, the top six, like your Arsenal, Man City, Liverpool, blah, would break away with the top Europeans, your Barcelona stuff, and create a Super League. And fuck me, you see all the men out at the clubs. As soon as that happened, they were out chanting and protesting. Yeah. And I was like, wow.
Pathetic, yeah.
That's it. There you've seen that freedom wasn't important, but my football was.
Right, so they've been conned. So in their hearts, they're decent men, I imagine, most 99% of them. But they've been conned. They've been given a substitute problem. They've been conned. And what part of the suffering is to realize you've been conned. You've been looking at the wrong thing. You've been misidentifying the problem. You've been tricked. That's a tough thing for a guy to realize you've been hoodwinked. It's tough, that. So it makes a humble, process start to unfold. Humility. And it's embarrassing for a lot of men. They'd rather just not know what's right and wrong and just keep themselves away from any humiliation or humility. But they've been conned. So if you want to be compassionate to our brothers and sisters who are doing stupid shit, they've been tricked. They've been gullible and naive, and somebody has conned them. They've given them pieces on a chessboard to look at whilst something else is going on behind them. And that con trick is, as I say, is millennia old. They were doing that in Persia. In 300 BC, they were tricking people. They were doing it in Rome in 100 AD here. They were tricking people, giving them activities to take their minds off it. And like I say, for one man, it's beer and football. For another man, it's, vintage claret and, opera or something. But it's the same principle. It's just bullshit. Those things are not it. That's not it. So we have to discipline ourselves. We have to suffer ourselves to look at reality, cold, hard, brutal reality. That's part of our endeavor and part of our command from God, no less.
You can see why. It's quite a deep term, and I think you might have heard it before, but for not wanting to blow smoke up your ass, but I've interviewed a lot of guys, and I often get asked a question of, who do you want to have on the podcast? If you could have anybody in the world. And your name has always been, after I listened to your Romecast, etc., the name that came up. And of course, naturally, I had one or two guys that would say, oh yeah, I've, listened to a Veritas podcast or something. But generally, it for me, one of the biggest things now is, how can you turn people's attention away from the jazz hands of what the TV shows you and onto what is the truth? So I thank you for that, because it's I'm always learning, and I'm about one step into the I think you might have said the staircase or the stairway of disbelief was a great
sure,
one.
Sure.
Looking at things as well. But what's next for you? Because I mean, we're coming up towards obviously Christmas, and does that mean for you that you're celebrating a traditional English Christmas out in the US, or is it now just a Thanksgiving? And
I don't really celebrate things like that, unless I'm supporting, as a sister-in-law or a brother-in-law or something, or some grandparent, who enjoys those things and wants to see me, and I'll play along with that a little tiny bit. But in my own home, and my wife is of the same perception as me, we don't really do that stuff. However, I love the time of year. I love November, December, January. I love it. And spiritually speaking, the solstice time of around the 20th, 21st, 22nd of December is a super potent time for contemplation and for perception and for regeneration. So I think it's a magical time of year. I used to love Christmas as a kid, and the trees and the lights, you know, it was very magical to me. So I don't really recognize any of the traditions. Christ was born, I think the data points to September, for example. So it doesn't recognize his birth. It just commemorates his birth and, you know, his life or whatever. So that's a legitimate thing to have a mass for Christ or whatever is okay. If somebody wants to do that, I'm totally happy to do that. Yeah. But I do that every day. I celebrate Christ every single day. So it's not, there's no special Sabbath day. There's no special Memorial Day for me for that. I do it every day, but I love the time of year. I do. So I look forward to it, and it snows where we are as well. So we get proper snow up to your waist or your shoulders, which I love. And that was my dream as a kid, was I want to go somewhere where there's loads of snow.
isn't it for all of us?
Yeah, it's great. So I love the time of year, just, you know, aesthetically and emotionally, just in myself, I love it. And, you know, I like the food and drink, and, you know, I'm very blessed that most of my family in America, through my wife's side, are lovely people. So it's nice to spend time with them. That's a rare blessing.
And what about coming back to the UK? I'm not talking about necessarily moving back. I mean, that could be a question, but have you been back regularly, or when you plan to come back at all?
No, I haven't been back for a long time. I love England. It's my home. There's nothing like it. But I've just been very busy here, doing things here. And as many of your listeners will know, America's so huge. It would take a lifetime to explore it, which is why most Americans are very America-centric. I always used to think that was very strange and a bit daft. But I understand now, because it's so bloody massive, the thing here. I mean, Oregon, where I used to live, is bigger than the entire United Kingdom. That's just one state. Texas is bigger than France.
Yeah.
You know, so that's another state. So it's just such a vast place that it's not any sort of disregard of England. I love England. It's just the exploration of this has just taken all my attention. You know, I'm just scratching the surface of it. So I've been here for 12 years now. And, you know, I've traveled also, you know, in Canada more, which was a long way from England, but here it's short. And also into Central America, which again is easy from here, the easy peasy. So it's been great. I love America. I love its way of life. I love its people. It's the most unracist place I've ever seen, the most freest place, protected free speech. You know, I love guns. I've always loved guns. I've shot as a kid with my father. We went shooting. So I love guns. So I have like pistols and rifles, and I love that. It's great to shoot again, which you couldn't really do that for a long time at all in England. Of course, you still can't. So I love that Second Amendment right to carry a gun is awesome. Absolutely awesome. It's the Wild West, it is. So you need a gun. It's cowboys and Indians, it is. But no, I love it. I love the States. But I would go back to England if my activities take me there, sure. And gladly, my mum and dad, who's my only sort of family there, they come over here. So I saw them in September or August in Utah. And my dad had been horse riding in Arizona and stuff. So, you know, it's great because they come here, which is awesome. So it would be difficult to not see my mum and dad. But because they've been so gracious and come over here so much, that's solved that problem.
Would they move over there?
I don't know. Maybe. I think my mother is a lot of a social life and a comfort, sir. England-based. My dad is a bit more inclined towards the way of life in the States. So I think what would be a nice thing is if they had the luxury to have a second home in the States would be a nice solution. I don't think they'd move over here permanently together, and they wouldn't want to be apart. So I think if I try and twist my dad's arm, he gets a home in Tucson or something, a second home, that would be awesome. But that's up to him. I don't know.
You've mentioned the travel thing as well. I mean, that's one of the biggest things for us with our kids is, you know, giving them a real, hate the term, but like the real world education of trying to, even if it's just in this country to start with, you know, we'll have the luck or the, what's the word I'm looking for? We won't have to be worried about term times. So, you know, when everybody else has to dash off in the same 2 weeks.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
We can do what we want. So, you know, we've got friends in even the, the chap we spoke to in Texas was like, hey, if you ever want to come over, you're, you know, you're more than welcome to come and visit us. So that's what we want to do, is try and give the boys a real world education. But
yeah, perfect.
I would wager getting them involved with listening to people like yourself would be a good start.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they'll listen to an old bastard like me, but well, maybe like when I'm dead and they're like in the 20s and 30s, you know, they might be starting to enjoy it then.
Yeah. Well, we always say, you know, I guess like for all of us, you can be mentored in life by people that are dead, you know.
Sure. That's my greatest audience, you know, when I'm dead. then people will start listening to me, I'm sure. You know, like Van Gogh or something. Oh, your paintings are okay, actually.
Just can't pick up the same royalties.
That's right. Yeah. There's no money in it at all, I'll tell you.
It's not very fruitful, but well, I will let you go because I appreciate your time. And I must say, I it's been absolute joy because I know I reached out.
My pleasure. Me too. Thank you.
Months and months and months ago. And I know you were very busy, but for me, it was like the top of the tree. I had triple asterisks next to your name on my podcast list.
Well, that's very kind of you. It's been a privilege to share in your project and to speak to some of your guys and whatnot. It's I believe what you're doing is very important, and all the different aspects that you show, all the different things. So it's been an honor to contribute in some way to it. Thank you.
Fantastic. It's a pleasure. And I won't say we'll invite you back because who knows what the world, how the world works out. But I always put it on my vision board that one day, not every podcast guest, but one day maybe I'll find myself out in the States coming to visit or see you speak at the Institute or something like that.
You just let me know what you're doing and we can spend some time together or make some recordings or whatever. It'd be good.
Awesome. But right, well, I will let you go. I appreciate all your time and hopefully we'll speak to you soon, Neil.
Okay, take care. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Remember to sign up to our game-changing weekly e-letter that's read by men around the world. Sign up at wholemanacademy.com/movement. Until next time.